So hello, welcome to another Future Pharmacists Conference session. This session couldn't be more about the future, really. The clue is in the title. So this session looks at the future role of the pharmacist in tackling the climate crisis. And there's a lot of noise, a lot of activity, a lot of crack around, you know, climate change and the looming what I feel is an emergency. Unfortunately, in life with emergencies, they often don't occur until they happen, and this is one I think where we have to get in there and start taking action now. So, who better to speak to than a member of one of the groups, a very new group in pharmacy actually, that is championing the role of the pharmacist and the wider pharmacy team in tackling that problem and helping everyone understand, I think, strategically what organizations can do and also probably what individuals can do. But I mean, here I am pontificating, and I don't know half of what Mina does. So on the line we've got Mina E, and just by way of introduction, Mina. So Mina is an advanced pharmacist practitioner in acute medicine. She's also vice chair of sustainability at the Guild of Healthcare Pharmacists, and also a member of this new group, Pharmacy Declares. And you'll find them on Twitter at Pharmacy Declares. And they're an environmentally conscious pharmacy professional group calling for climate health action, leadership, education, declaration, and divestment. So Mina, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you so much for inviting me along to talk about my favorite topic.
Good, good. Well, it's nice to finally meet you, because there is no doubt you are making an impact, and not just you, of course. I mean, your colleagues. So tell me, I think let's just start at the start. I mean, the whole conference is about the future of pharmacists, but also we need to be cognizant of the wider healthcare team and wider pharmacy team. So where did your group, let's just start at the start, where did your group come from? How did it start? What's the crack, basically?
Yeah, definitely. So I think each individual in a group has already started their climate and health journey somewhere. It was just so nice to have everyone together. So Tracy, the founder of the group, Tracy Lyons, she's done some amazing work already herself in her trust. So she went through, I think it was Health Declares. It's an organization linking up a lot of networks that's declaring a climate emergency. So through Health Declares, put out a tweet and say, are you a pharmacy professional interested in climate change and tackling the health impacts associated with it? So I personally joined that way, but I think she was already in touch with various different people in pharmacy world and trying to get a meeting together to see what we can do. So when we first met up virtually, because it was still during lockdown and nobody can see each other apart from virtually. So we got together, and each of us not really knowing what to do or where to go from there, we just know what we need to. Well, we know about the emergency, but we don't know what angle to go with. So we were just scouting out for what other groups are doing. So there's a very active group already. Doctors in Extinction Rebellion consists of loads of medical consultants and junior doctors. They're advocating for various different things in their hospitals and their workplaces. There's the likes of the Greener Practice, which is set up by a group of GPs working on respiratory health and associated things with climate change, that's like air pollution. So they're already doing a lot of work. So then we were like, what can pharmacy do? So obviously, undoubtedly, the area we're going to tackle is medicines. What can we do about medicines? The net zero document was published by the NHS, a greener NHS, in 2019, just before we went into a major lockdown in the first wave. So I think the work kind of shelved from that, because there was going to be a big launch and leading up to COP26 this year. But it was kind of delayed. But luckily, it picked up recently again. And those things are happening around the country. So we kind of jumped on the bandwagon and started having conversations, loud conversations, advocating for leadership in this area, because pharmacists always tell me wherever medicine's involved, pharmacy should be involved. So a lot of people are already working on the area of medicines, but there's no pharmacist in it. So we were like, we want to take a lead on this, because who better understands the pharmacy supply chain and operations in pharmacy than pharmacists and pharmacy professionals?
Totally agree. And over the years, regular readers and viewers and listeners will know that, and I am smiling here, tongue in cheek, I have been known to be a bit cynical about the term leadership. But I think leadership's one of these ethereal things that, it doesn't exist all the time, but when it does exist, you see it and you feel it. And I think, I would pay you guys a compliment because you're in our profession, I think at the moment, you're forging ahead. And definitely it feels like you are encouraging action in others. And that's very positive action. One question I had, so I mean, there are political overtones to what you're doing. Where does the group sit? I mean, maybe you haven't really thought about this, to be honest, but where does the group sit on the political spectrum? Or have you decided yet whether you're, is it a like a traditional right wing thing or left wing thing, or what, what's the is the is it tagged on to a particular type of politics, or is this just apolitical and everyone's welcome?
So I think it's a group for everyone. So in terms of where our political views align, I suppose a lot of it aligns with the Green New Deal that, well, I certainly am part of MEDACT. So it's a registered charity, and we're fighting for social and environmental economic injustice. So I can speak for me, but not on the other members of the group, that I am championing and endorsing the Green New Deal. And as part of the Guild of Healthcare Pharmacists, who sits within Unite and Labour, Unite also, I think, endorsed the Green New Deal back 2 years ago already. And they have an environmental task force meeting up regularly to discuss what we can do. So just briefly explain what the Green New Deal is. So in MEDACT, the junior doctors and a few people who are activists campaigning for essentially five major things, really. So the first one is to decarbonize energy system. And we know in recent Labour Party conference, they have endorsed the Green New Deal and voted to adopt it. So I think they champion for nationalizing the energy system. So we know that a lot of carbon emission is linked to fossil fuel. So the energy system majority is currently dependent on fossil fuel, and that's going to be detrimental to global warming and climate change, as a result, air pollution, as a result, a threat to human health. So that's one of the things we're championing for, decarbonizing the energy system and make it all renewable. Now, the second thing is green jobs for all. So I was part of the panel and speaking on building a health movement for the Green New Deal when MEDACT launched their public health case for the Green New Deal. So we were saying that. So I was saying that, there's a lot of cuts in pharmacy at a minute, funding cuts. And I said, you're losing a lot of community pharmacy, and pharmacy jobs are green jobs. So you need to keep jobs that are green. We need more incentive from government to keep these green jobs in place. And we need to help the just transition period, where I think it was estimated there could be 1.2 million green jobs created in this just transition document, a duration. So we're advocating for government to support schemes, job schemes that are green, to, like people in, we know there's loads of people employed in the fossil fuel industry. We can't be like, you're going to lose your job now. We hate what you're doing to the climate. So we need this period of retraining, if you like, of the existing workers in that industry into a renewable source of energy industry or other jobs that might be aligned with them. So we're advocating for green jobs. Healthy air is the other one that we're advocating for. So a lot of pollution in London, so a lot of noise has been made in London in terms of building cycle lanes and subsidizing public transport and encouraging active travel. Because we know, well, 10 years ago, there was a 9-year-old girl whose death was linked to air pollution, and that was in her death certificate. That was the first in the world. And 10 years later, are we any, where are we? We're still pretty much in the same place. So we want to fight for cleaner air. And there's a lot of networks out there fighting for this, working together with councils. And the other thing we are, you probably heard it in the news actually, Insulate Britain, the group of climate activists in blocking M25. So I'm in a mixed opinion on what they're doing. I think their message has kind of been lost in kind of their tactics. But their message is important, why they want to insulate homes. So in 2018, there was estimate of 17,000 people that died from preventable deaths as a result of poor housing. And it was highlighted by the BMA that poor housing condition links to, you know, poor childhood development, links to the mental health and physical health impact. So that was the other thing in the Green New Deal that we're advocating for. And the last one is food and land justice. So 70% of UK land is for agriculture, and that's not even enough. We have more lands abroad that's used for agriculture, importing meat. And we know that it accounts for a quarter of global greenhouse gas emission, the industry. And that also associated with, you know, soil degradation, water pollution from fertilizers, etc. So, and that ultimately affects human health. So yeah, these are the things that we're advocating in a Green New Deal. So whoever endorses the Green New Deal is, I think for me, aligns with what I value politically. But for the group, certainly, so I talked about the first thing, fossil fuel investments. So you've probably already seen that we've been advocating for divestment in fossil fuels. And we've been having conversations with our Royal Pharmaceutical Society. They're just publishing their policy document 3rd of November. We were very keen to see what they're going to do in terms of their investment portfolio. And another group of a big organization that we've written letters to multiple times but had no replies from is the GPHC. So our regulatory body, the people that we paid our membership money to every month, every year, sorry, if you do a direct debit, it would be every month, won't it? So they have ignored us from the beginning. And we know from insiders that they hold investments in fossil fuels through freedom of information requests. And we want to know what they're doing about it, because that's our membership money that they're taking. So politically that way, it's complicated because these are our regulatory bodies. These are the people that represent us, and we want them to do the right thing. But we need more voices to call for them to do the right thing.
I think there's very, very comprehensive summary there, Mina. Thank you very much. So much within that, like, to discuss. You know, the just transition, I think that's a whole topic. Land reform, I mean, you know, I could speak to where we live up here in Scotland. I actually think it'd be interesting to see what comments we get under this recording and so on and so forth. But I think you'll be pushing an open door with the RPS. I think strategically, it, based on where they're brand or where they've positioned their brand, I think you'll do quite well there. GPHC, it's usually one-way communication with the GPHC in my experience, isn't it? Do this by then and pay the money and we'll let you back on to register. I think you're asking the right questions of the right people, knowing some of the people personally in the GPHC and having interviewed Duncan Rudkin before. I must apologize, I never asked him about climate change, so that was my bad, but I certainly will next time we get to chat. That'll be top of my list. But knowing that they are reasonable people, and I think if there's a direction of travel, they'll follow it. Probably it might be fair to say there's quite a lot of bureaucracy in terms of getting change made within that organization. That said, and this is another reason why I think your movement is so interesting at the moment. That said, the amount of change during the pandemic, in various organizations has set a lot of precedents, hasn't it? And, like GPHC, I mean, we reported the whole lot on pharmacy and practice, and there were a few months I was like, oh my goodness, like, there's so much change, delaying, revalidation, lots and lots of, chunky big moves that were done basically overnight. So in a way, they've made, not just the GPHC, but other organizations as well. They've kind of made a rod for their own back in a way by setting a precedent that things can change pretty rapidly. How do you see, like, I suppose I'm interested to, well, I'm always a bit cynical, I never take things at face value. It's a bit exhausting at times, but, and in terms of like taking it back, to sort of practicing pharmacists, I talk quite a lot about, or have talked quite a lot about over the years, pharmaceutical care. It's where we all feel, well, the majority I think feel where modern pharmacy practice emerged from back in 1990, and moving on from that sort of supply function and all that. What do you think, without being specific about products, or oh, maybe you might want to be specific, what can the pharmacist, let's say the pharmacist locum in a community pharmacy, how can they have an impact like today to help you?
I think we're talking about pharmacists and pharmacy professional as an individual, when it, separately and as an individual, what can they do, and collectively, what can they do, and what pharmacies can do. So as a locum pharmacist, so I suppose things like a lot of people are currently advocating for recycling. So does the pharmacy has a recycling bin in the first place? Can you influence I suppose not the bigger chains, can you influence the independent pharmacy to look into recycling scheme? And we know PSNC has commissioned a service recently in the PQSMs to say that if you counsel patients to return the inhalers to pharmacy instead of letting it go to landfill and then the gas canisters escape and causes the greenhouse gas escapes and causes global warming. So what other thing can you counsel them on? What about not flushing your antibiotics liquids down the sink? What about not chucking your medicines in landfill and that are cytotoxic and that might damage the environment and our biodiversity eventually? So yeah, counseling and patient education is what we can do well, and public health is key. And I said earlier the talk about inhalers, DPIs, PMDIs, but what about like healthy living? What fighting air pollution? And what about stop smoking? So it can prevent respiratory health, the damage to respiratory health in the first place. Isn't that better than advocating for a green product so we don't need to use the product in the first place? So things that pharmacists already do, but I think there need to be a bigger push to do it better. So better eating, lifestyle management, essentially, better monitoring of their condition. So, and the other day I was in a talk that says the cost of having a patient being on Ramipril versus the cost of them exercising and being referred through to green prescribing, social prescribing for better lifestyle choices and coaching them through it. And the result of that is someone being on Ramipril for the next 5 years, or someone who doesn't need to be on Ramipril for the blood pressure and living a healthy lifestyle, which has not just a blood pressure impact, but everything else as well. So I think pharmacists have a big role in terms of in public health, in preventing ill health. And this is what our group is advocating for, isn't it? So to prevent the emergency, so we know what the emergency is and what the impact is going to be. How do we prevent that? So it's the preventative measure. And in terms of individual, what you can do as well, so things like, I don't know how detail you want to go into, so things like what you put on your plate. So do you have meat-free days? I'm not asking you to go vegan. I'm asking you to think about how much plastic is associated with the vegetables you buy. How can you help? Do you know what the impact of beef and livestock and the environment and the methane production? So I suppose it's more education and awareness of individuals as well. How do you travel to work? If you live two streets down the pharmacy, can you walk? Why do you have to drive an SUV? And can you, if you drive an electric car, can you advocate for your pharmacies to have an electric charging point? Because at the minute, there's a lot of incentives to install a charging point. It might not be in the future. And I think as well that I suppose lobbying is a big thing, and joining green groups. So if you join a green group, you're more empowered to have that collective voice. So it's not just one locum pharmacist advocating for this. It's a group of you and brainstorming what you can do collectively together. And I suppose in a recent survey we've done with GHP as well, in terms of sustainability, collecting everybody's views, the overwhelmingly, a lot of people said that there's a lack of leadership and guidances on what individuals and collectively what they can do. So Keith Ridge, the chief pharmaceutical officer, has led a big research study and shows that we are overprescribing. We've known this for a long time. So what can we do in terms of reducing waste from overprescribing and subsequently stockpiling? So things like having conversations with patients and be truthful about the drugs that they take. So in hospital, I work in acute medicine hospital. When I do a medication history taking, I use a different tactic now in terms of asking whether they actually take the drugs. So Mary, who's 90, and when I went to see her, she had her dentures on the table and she's on Adcal D3 chewable. And I just go, how can you take the Adcal D3 chewable? Can you chew with your dentures? And she goes, no, I cannot chew it at all, so I don't take it. So that's one way of having that conversation. And the other thing is when people say, yep, I take it twice a day. And then I was like, do you take two in the morning? Do you split it one twice a day? And they go, oh. And then I go, well, you know, a lot of people tell me they don't take them because they taste like chalk. What do you think? And they go, actually, yeah, I don't take them. I haven't been taking them for months now. So provoking that conversation and make them feel okay to say that they are not taking their tablets and finding out why is one of the things pharmacists can do, I feel, because we then can suggest an alternative and then go back to the GP and say, look, Mary's not taking this because of this. I suggest we try this and going forward and see how we can do. So these are the things pharmacists already can do, medicines optimization, and having that conversation about medicines with patients is what we do best. So in terms of that way and reducing waste and reducing overprescribing to help the environment, I think that's what pharmacists can do too.
So really interesting. So would you say it's an oversimplification to say something like, prescribing no drugs, no medicines is the most carbon or, environmentally friendly option?
I think you know the term reduce, reuse, recycle. It's the hierarchy that way. So if you can reduce the need of it in the first place, then you don't need to reuse or recycle. And subsequently, that has a big environmental impact. So obviously, I'm not saying that don't take your drugs, because obviously some drugs are essential. But if we can identify people who are not taking the drugs in the first place, and people are prescribing it as per guidelines to satisfy the prescriber's liability in a way, I've prescribed them, I'm following guidelines. I don't really care what if the patients are taking or not. I've this is on their record. I'm optimizing their diabetes management. But if they're not taking it in the first place, you're not doing them any better. So I think it's about having an honest conversation on how do we manage you otherwise if you choose not to take this. Can we, like, going back to healthy lifestyle promotion, going back to, I don't know, having a conversation with a group of people, a support group, and just thinking outside the box other than a prescription and a tablet, really, on how to manage the patients socially, and what they value.
I'm just thinking, it's an interesting conversation, isn't it? I'm just thinking of, like, you know, like the wider sort of medicine system, and I am probably guilty of oversimplifying it for the purposes of this chat, so apologies for that, but for the sake of having the conversation, I think it's worth it. I always, you know, when someone comes in and tries to make a change, I always think so pharmacy is a big old ecosystem, and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of individual agendas, there's a lot of organizational agendas, there's a lot of investment tied up in doing things a certain way. Deprescribing is one of those interesting ones. So, you know, I wondered what you thought on, you know, how the community pharmacy, particularly the community pharmacy network, might feel about suggesting deprescribing, because that's going to, you know, at the end of the day, that's going to lose them money. Do you recognize that link? And is there a way, do you know what I mean? Is there a way to sort of help everyone get over that, rather than just, you know, maybe I'm not saying the group is rubbing anybody up the wrong way. I don't think you are. I think, like, every, you know, I would be surprised if anybody in their right mind is in general terms against an environmental sort of climate change action, really. But at the end of the day, money talks, and, you know, if put yourself in the position of a pharmacy owner, and if a pharmacy owner sort of does 6,000 items a month, and because of the, you know, a deprescribing initiative, that pharmacy owner then subsequently only does 5,500 a month, that's quite hard to sell. And that's what I'm trying to say is that's a structural contractual thing. So have you guys got plans to sort of have that conversation, be upfront about it? And if so, what would you like to change? And who can pull, who do you need to convince? Like, who can pull those levers, Minna?
That's a very interesting question there, and linked to a lot of things that's been talked about already. So, so you have, we said earlier, the big pharma companies. They are having great sales of their products that we know are churning high carbon emission. Why would they change, and why would they go on the climate crisis and fight when they're going to lose a big chunk of investment and money? And same with fossil fuel industry. Why would they want to do anything different when they're making, I don't know, £4 billion of public money was given to the North Sea oil and gas company since the Paris Agreement was signed. So why would they change things that are making them money? So I want to ask, I know the pharmacy pressures and the pharmacy owners' woes about funding, but I think there are many things that we can claim funding for other ways other than this little avenue. So things like we do for free already in pharmacies, the delivery of medications currently is funded through the COVID incentive. But if we've been delivering medications for free for so many decades, shouldn't we start saying to people, no, you're going to pay us for this. This is an extra service. And things like we're making up MDS boxes for people for free, that's coming out of the community pharmacies on budget. Should we start charging an extra cost that's attached to this? Because you're using extra plastic as well. So I suppose in a way a carbon tax for purchasing your products. And pharmacies are doing a lot of extra services, if you like, for free as well. So there's a lot of things that we can start clawing back money for, and they should take a stance on what we should be getting paid for the service that we provide. And I think we've been very generous so far in terms of what we've provided. And in terms of consultation wise as well, people come into your pharmacy without an appointment, without an appointment time. They come in anytime. They have a free medical consultation, if you like, in your consultation room. And that's often not recorded. And that results in a sale. And should we be starting to look at a consultation service where if you want health advice, I don't know, Johnny, I'm just throwing things out there to say that the only source of money is not from prescription. That there's a lot of things that we're doing in terms of if you go to, it's so hard to access other services, but pharmacies are so accessible. But should we start making it less accessible? But that's not the right thing, obviously. But if you want to survive, pharmacies to survive, I think that's probably what we should be doing. We should be asking government for money, NHS England for money, NHS Scotland for money for all the great services that we do. And there are already great services out there that's come out in the recent years, you know, CPCS and the briefly commissioned emergency supply scheme. So these are the things we should be getting paid for because we've been doing them for free. So yeah, you've run out of tablets, I'll just loan you some. You're my regular, but why are we doing it for free? So starting to have that conversation, I think, and clawing the money back that way.
Well, this is not a I'm not shoehorning in a plug for my side hustle, which is making dog beds and chairs out of old whiskey barrels from Scotland. However, I offer free delivery. I mean, partly because I like getting out and about and meeting folk and what have you. But the decision there is and this is just talking about my little side hustle here, right? So, you know, if I sell a dog bed for 50 quid, it costs me X amount to make it. If I deliver it 10 miles, you know, 45p a mile, that to me, that's an investment that I'm making in that sale to get the sale. And, you know, at the end of the day, my margin on that particular sale will be lower, but I'll get the sale. And I'll maybe generate, you know, obviously you get all the goodwill that goes with a delivery. So you'll, you know, they'll love their dog bed and, you know, and you'll turn up at their door, ta-da, here's your dog bed, you know, and they, you know, they get a good impression. So there's potential customer loyalty for the future. You see the point I'm making. So I think I hear this like, you know, like free thing bandied about and you addressed it really well, actually, but I don't think it's free. I don't think it ever has been free. I think it's a conscious decision by the pharmacy owners, because I would probably do it if I was a pharmacy owner and there was enough money sloshing around in the turnover of the business. You know, you would invest. You'd say to yourself, right, I'm going to pay a member of staff to make up these cassette boxes because I know if I do that, or if I present the medicines in a certain way, we do original packs now to care homes, but you get the point. You're going to get that patient and you're going to have a loyal customer slash patient. So I don't think it's, I don't sort of buy this idea. I mean, maybe folk will disagree or get upset. I think there is a narrative that we've been doing stuff for free and it's like there's some annoyance at the paymasters for that. I would, to be honest, I would have limited sympathy. And going back to the barrel dog bed example, you know, doing free deliveries is an investment, and the business owner has taken a conscious decision. There may be, like, we've all done free deliveries when it's just totally altruistic. That's different. But in general, if you've invested in a van, in a driver, you know, that's a business decision. So you're deciding to take a lower margin. So I think what you say is interesting. I was also told off. That's wrong. Chastised, disagreed with by Karen Harrowing, and she made a really good point to me to not, because I keep going on about the NHS being community pharmacy's customer, and it's not. She's absolutely right. The customer really is the patient in community pharmacy because they are a business. So going back to what you were saying, I think it's really, it's an interesting chat because it's really hard because I think the community pharmacy network across all countries now, I don't think Scotland's particularly much different at the moment, although it is a bit. And don't I hope folk don't take this word wrong. It's an economic term. You know, I think they're stuck in a lazy economy, so you know a lot of their money come, you know, the vast majority of the money in community pharmacy still comes from supply, where more is more. And it talks to what you were speaking about around, you know, why would a pharmaceutical company come and champion a scheme that compromises that? It just, from a purely business point of view, it just doesn't make sense, which is where the question around, you know, what levers and who do you have to influence comes from. I think, I don't know what, if anybody's interested, but my own opinion would be that you're probably pushing the right doors. You know, I mean, the RPS are really good at advocating. GPHC, of course, regulate us. You know, they have an important role. And chief pharmaceutical officers, as well, to be honest. What do you think of that kind of, you know, banishing of the free? You know, I just think there's this thing that all community pharmacy owners are altruistic, and we all are at times, but I think that's maybe a wee bit disingenuous, because to take on a delivery driver, do other stuff for free is a decision. Would you agree?
So I think it's interesting because I've had this conversation with a few community pharmacy owners before. So if I tell you there's 10 grand tomorrow to get your delivery charges reimbursed, would you claim it? You would. So I think if we collectively lobby for NHS for more money for community pharmacy to deliver these extra services that we've been doing for free and not doing it for free, then you can claw back, like I say, you can claw back your money that way. You don't have to rely on, there's no loyalty aspect. I'm not asking the patients to pay for it. I'm asking big organizations to cough out some money to pay for these things that we're doing for, like, out of goodwill, out of loyalty, I suppose. But I think we've been doing it for too long. We've been too nice. It's time to start reviewing what we've been doing all these decades and say, these are the data of what we've been doing. We're saving people from who can't come out their house. We've been going through their house, giving them medicines. Do we think district nurses visit houses and take bloods and give their insulin for free? They get paid to do that. Do you know what I mean? So, and big levers, I suppose. So people in supply chain have been told, NHS supply chain, by 2030, if you don't have a green strategy or your company is not proven to be green or sustainable in a way, NHS is terminating contracts with existing companies, like decades-long relationship with them instantly because they haven't got a sustainable strategy. So in pharmacy, where is our supply? What does that mean for our supply chain, and what do we need to do? So, people in I think it's NHS Highlands have been ahead with us for this already. So, in terms of their regional procurement of drugs, in their application form for a new drug to be included, they have you considered the environmental impact of this drug to be added onto the formulary? So, increasingly, up and down the country, a lot of formulary decisions already have been added on this clause. Have you considered the environmental impact of the drug before adding this to your formulary? And I think there needs to be more eco-pharmacovigilance as well from, you know, like MHRA, in terms of researching what these drugs in our supplies, water supply system, and the environment are doing. And there's a big one that came out not long ago. I don't know if you remember, about diclofenac and vultures. So a lot of vultures, so a lot of diclofenac were fed to livestock, and vultures are in a decline in a certain area. And they were wondering why. So vultures have been eating the carcasses of these animals, and which instantly resulted in death from kidney failure. And their post-mortem found that they have visceral gout in the body. So that led to a change in usage of drugs widely in livestock. So yeah, so not much human medicines as well. Animal medicine, livestock medicines, we have to consider. And the big people to do it are from the top down, essentially. This supply chain, people sitting in regional formulary teams, chief pharmacists in hospitals in terms of their strategies, what they've put in place to be more sustainable. There's so much in this that can be done collectively. And if I think the main thing for me, if people can sit together and have that conversation and not work in silos, because I have a pet peeve of people working in silos and not sharing information, and then other people duplicating work elsewhere when it's already been done and it can be replicated elsewhere in the first place. So I think people need to have that conversation. And so what I've suggested today might not be the best solution, but what is the best solution? So can you tell me in your experience in your field and your wise knowledge that what we can do better and how we can tackle the emergency individually in our area?
It's complicated. It's going to take someone much cleverer than me to do that. But I think it's good that you're asking the questions. I think it's these things are always about the ecosystem, and it sounds rather cynical and for and a bit boring. But usually if you follow the money, you'll under you know the If you follow the money, the downstream, put it this way, if you follow the money, the downstream decisions start to make sense. And that includes in the NHS and so on. And the thing I would say about the NHS, and this is just a personal opinion and my observation working with and in and around it for years, money isn't always the currency in the NHS. It's often reputation, kudos, career building, actually. It's a very big organization, and there's a lot of non-money incentives going on, as far as I can see, which is quite interesting as well. But it's really complicated. I think you've got to look at who pulls the levers and try and influence them as best you can. I think another point I was wanting to ask you about before we finish, and this is thinking more, about, younger pharmacists or pharmacists coming onto the register at any age. Do you think pharmacists coming through onto the register now, when you're looking to take a job, for example, do pharmacists look at the green credentials of a company now?
I'm hoping so. So this is one of the things we've been working on in terms of, so in pharmacy declares, there's a trainee pharmacist currently working with a head of pharmacy school in what we call a planetary health report card. It's already been done in America in terms of how sustainable each individual medical schools are. So they also have, they're trying to work out how sustainable each individual pharmacy school is. And we've been trying to, we had meetings about incorporating sustainability into the MPharm curriculum to teach climate change to undergraduate students. It's already currently been taught to medical students because it's part of their GMC curricula to promote planetary health. So I think pharmacy should be doing the same, or hoping to be doing the same soon. And certain schools of pharmacy are already leading on this. I know in Queen's in Belfast that Roche, who is the academic in Queen's there, she's interviewed pharmacy students recently to in Band 6's jobs and say, what are your views, climate change, climate emergency, what are your views in terms of what pharmacy and pharmacists can do? And I think the response was a lot of people went down the sustainable workforce and health and well-being route rather than thinking about the wider what the green agenda is. So I think there needs to be more awareness and education. And I think a lot of people have picked up on it. Yesterday, I think the BPSA had a meeting and they're going to promote sustainability in their next conference, I believe. And there are a lot of people in HEE, CPPE, the likes of are talking about developing a module to educate the future workforce, undergrad and postgrad level, on what we can be doing and what are health impacts if we don't mitigate the risk of this. So I think number one is to be climate aware and educated on I think because once you're aware, you naturally want to take action. That is the next step. You would want to see what you can do individually, and then you join the green group, and then what you as a collective can do. And the impact would be massive. I think like what we've done in Pharmacy Declares, we've all been doing this in individually for silently for a number of years. But when we come together and brainstorm on what we can do, and that's when the major impact is. For me personally, in the future, certainly if I apply for jobs, if a company, if a trust is not green, that is really less appealing to me. Really, really. It's in my mind now to look at how sustainable the trust is. So I've been doing a lot of work in my trust to try and them to go greener faster. They have already done amazing work in terms of using recycled paper, installing electric charging points. They're looking at their canteen menu now to have a more vegan veggie option to promote meat-free days. But the likes of Newcastle Hospital, they're the first hospital to declare a climate emergency. And they have e-cargo bikes delivering medications to people. And that was received really well. So if you have services like that in place, I will be asking in job interviews in the future, if I do change job, that what are your green ethos? Because if you have none, I don't think I want to work for you.
See, that's fascinating. And that's the reason I asked that question was because partly because I give pharmacy owners a hard time in the last question about free deliveries and stuff, but also like I see that as an opportunity for community pharmacy owners, for you know NHS employers, in such a tough like you know workforce environment. I think we recognise that there's a lot going on with the pharmacy workforce across a lot of sectors at the moment, and it's from an employer point of view, it's tougher to find the pharmacists or the pharmacy team members that you need. To be honest, you know what we could talk all day. But I've got one of the other sessions is on locum pharmacists, and no doubt we'll touch on that there. But I just think that's an opportunity. You know, that's a box that an organisation could tick. I'm not saying they should be cynical and just tick it for the sake of ticking it, but you know, it's what I was saying. It's one of those. I think it's one of those levers. It's one of the bricks in the wall of stuff like structurally that can be done to start making the change towards where you want us all to go. So I think that's really good. I'm gonna finish it quite shortly. You've been really generous with your time, Minna. Thank you so much. It's been so interesting talking to you. Now, this is the Future Pharmacist Conference, so every guest that comes on, I'm asking one question. So I apologize, I haven't prepped you for this. So good luck. But what do you see the role of the future pharmacist in 20 years' time? You know, and by that I mean what would you like to see different in or what difference would you like to see in the role of the pharmacist? Let's say in 20 years' time.
So in 5 years' time, was it that the NPharm curriculum has changed and prepped everyone to be independent prescribers? So I take it that they're going to be taught clinical skills and the knowledge required to prescribe at an earlier stage than what the current workforce have been that require additional training, etc. So when you have a future workforce that's already prepped so well in terms of their clinical skills and, you know, diagnosis and management, then your postgrad education would be more advanced, I would imagine. So can pharmacists read basic ECGs? Can pharmacists listen to a chest in pharmacies to make a presumptuous diagnosis and then refer on if they think it's a red flag? So more advanced stuff, level stuff in pharmacies, provided we get paid for it. Because we are taking away some, so I suppose it will create a bit of a competition, and you know, people will have the slander of, you know, we're not medics, we're not doctors, and we shouldn't be doing this. But there are evidence that consultant pharmacists can do so well. So what makes you think that we can't do it as well? So I think in the future there'll be more, we can take a lot of clinical work on that currently patients are struggling to get access to. I suppose facilities need to be put in place as well for people who's designing the services in the future. For example, if I want to get a urine dip done and get sent to the pathology lab, can pharmacies do that and, get paid for that to send to pathology lab and then interpret the results as a result from that and then subsequently prescribe something? Can we manage blood pressure if it's a long-term thing? Patients just need to come to pharmacies rather than make appointments with their GP to manage a blood pressure issue and spot red flags and refer them on to a GP only if something's critical. So I think the future workforce will be better clinically prepared and, well, I hope ready to tackle scenarios better than the current workforce have been because we've not been trained for that. The current workforce is not. I've not been taught the skills that my juniors currently have been taught at university level and subsequently in their post-grad level. So I think they'll be more prepared and ready to take on the world essentially. And they might come up with their own ideas on what they can do and what they want to see pharmacy do with their level of knowledge and expertise in the future.
Wonderful, lovely, really positive vision for the future. And one that I agree with, to be honest, like, I suppose I've had a taste of doing slightly more advanced things in my career and really enjoyed it. I guess I just, yeah, like you, I wish it was sort of baked in from the start, and there was an expectation that advanced practice was where everyone should go, really, because it gives us an option to move away from that supply function completely, which I think will eventually automate anyway. But listen, it's been great speaking to you, Minna. Lovely to meet you as well. Hopefully meet you in person at some stage. And yeah, thank you so much for your time. Very interesting insights, and hope you enjoyed the chat.
Thank you for having me on and tackling this very topical topic in time for COP26.
Indeed, well remembered, well remembered. Thank you so much, Mina, and I'll see you soon, okay?
See you soon.